And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
Former President Donald Trump was indicted for a fourth time on Monday, 14th of August, by a grand jury investigating whether he illegally interfered in the 2020 election in Georgia. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, has indicted former President Donald Trump and more than a dozen of his associates with election fraud, racketeering, and other charges relating to the alleged effort to overturn the 2020 election. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis said at a news conference on Monday night, 14th of August, that arrest warrants have been issued for all of the defendants in the case, and they have until noon on 25th of August to surrender. Donald Trump, the first former president in the U.S. history to face criminal charges, has now been charged in four separate cases involving allegations that bookend his presidency. The indictment names Trump as the top defendant and 18 others, including Rudy Giuliani, his former lawyer, John Eastman, a conservative lawyer, and Mark Meadows, former White House chief of staff. Other co-defendants include Jeffrey Clark, a former Justice Department official, and Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis, conservative lawyers who pushed baseless claims of voter fraud. The court filing lists 41 total counts, including 13 against Donald Trump, and notes there are 30 unindicted co-conspirators. In all, 19 defendants are charged with the offense of violation of the Georgia RICO Act, among other charges. The indictment describes the group as a criminal organization whose members and associates engaged in various related criminal activities, including, but not limited to, false statements and writings, impersonating a public officer, forgery, filing false documents, influencing witnesses, computer theft, computer trespass, computer invasion of privacy, conspiracy to defraud the state, acts involving theft and perjury. The 98-page indictment lays out a scheme that began with Trump's loss in the 2020 presidential election, including in the state of Georgia, and says that those charged refused to accept that Donald Trump had lost, and they knowingly and willfully joined a conspiracy to unlawfully change the outcome of the election in favor of Trump. That conspiracy contained a common plan and purpose to commit two or more acts of racketeering activity in Fulton County, Georgia, elsewhere in the state of Georgia, and in other states, the court filing says. The indictment describes several schemes allegedly used by Trump and his co-defendants to attempt to reverse the electoral loss, including making false statements to state legislatures and top state officials, creating fake electoral college documents, and recruiting supporters to cast false votes at the Georgia Capitol, harassing Fulton County election worker Ruby Freeman, and corruptly soliciting senior Justice Department officials and then Vice President Mike Pence. It also accuses members of the enterprise of stealing data, including ballot images, voting equipment software, and personal voter information from Coffee County, Georgia, and making false statements to government investigators. The indictment charges Donald Trump with the following felony counts: violating the Georgia RICO Act, three counts of solicitation of violation of oath by public officer, conspiracy to commit impersonating a public officer, conspiracy to commit forgery in the first degree, conspiracy to commit false statements and writings, two counts of conspiracy to commit filing false documents, conspiracy to commit forgery in the first degree, two counts of false statements and writings, and filing false documents. The grand jury returned the indictments around 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and it took around 2 hours to process before the details became public. The investigation, led by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, was prompted in part by a 2nd of January 2021 phone call in which Donald Trump told Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, "I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have. because we won the state. In a September 2022 statement, Donald Trump called his conversation with Raffensperger an absolutely perfect phone call in which he did nothing wrong. Donald Trump has since repeated that the call was perfect, including at a 7th of August rally in New Hampshire. United Press International, UPI, has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump was indicted for a fourth time on Monday, 14th of August, by a grand jury investigating whether he and 18 other defendants named in the 98-page indictment illegally interfered in the 2020 election in Georgia. The indictment names a total of 19 defendants, including Donald Trump, his former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and lawyer John Eastman. Defendant Donald John Trump lost the United States presidential election held on 3rd of November 2020, the indictment reads. One of the states he lost was Georgia. Trump and the other defendants charged in this indictment refused to accept that Trump had lost, and they knowingly and willfully joined a conspiracy to unlawfully change the outcome of the election in favor of Trump. That conspiracy contained a common plan and purpose to commit two or more acts of racketeering activity in Fulton County, Georgia, elsewhere in the state of Georgia, and in other states. Judge Robert McBurney said, "That's it," as he signed off on the indictments from the jury without reading any of the names of the defendants. Fulton County, Georgia District Attorney Fannie Willis told reporters shortly after the indictment was unsealed that the defendants will have until noon on 25th of August to voluntarily surrender themselves or face arrest. As is the normal process in Georgia law, the grand jury issued arrest warrants for those who are charged, Fannie Willis said late on Monday night. "I'm giving the defendants the opportunity to voluntarily surrender themselves no later than noon on Friday, the 25th day of August, 2023. Willis reminded reporters that the indictment is only a series of allegations based on a grand jury's determination of probable cause to support the charges. The 19 people named in Monday's indictment are Donald John Trump, Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Mark Meadows, Kenneth Chesbrough, Jeffrey Clark, Jenna Ellis, Ray Smith, Robert Cheely, Michael Roman, David Schaefer, Sean Steele, Stephen Lee, Harrison Floyd, Trevion Cutty, Sidney Powell, Kathy Latham, Scott Hall, and Misty Hampton.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African Regional Bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Nigerian military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path. The United Kingdom is hit with yet another strike action as junior doctors have launched a new walkout amid continued disputes with the government over pay and working conditions. The four-day strike began on Friday and continues until Tuesday. It includes actions by doctors just days into the medical practice. Doctors say their walkout has reached a tipping point due to the government's failure to deliver on its promises. The junior doctors demand a 35% rise, but but the government says that is unrealistic and not negotiable. It is proposing a fourth of what junior doctors are asking for. The action is set to impact tens of millions of people receiving services from the National Health Service or NHS. The walkout could push only the number of appointments cancelled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million.
Pay us or lose us!
Save our NHS!
Save our NHS!
Rishi Sunak, hear us shout!
Pay us properly or get out!
NHS officials have warned of massive disruptions as a result of the strike action taken by the junior doctors.
This latest round of junior doctors' strikes will again significantly disrupt services for patients. The additional changes this time is that organizations are unable to use agency workers to cover staff out on a strike. It is also a period of time where NHS staff often take annual leave, so there are already gaps in the workplace.
The comments by Dr. Powis comes as the number of people on waiting lists for treatment has surged to a record 7.6 million. In the past months, UK nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical workers have all joined industrial action across the NHS, mounting more pressure on the government to address the economic woes and financial stress on the public health service workers. The four-day stoppage by junior doctors come as the British Medical Association, or BMA, which represents strikers, says the take-home pay of junior doctors has plunged by 26% in the last 15 years. BMA says it will continue to campaign for better pays for its members after branding the public sector pay rise announced by the government in July as insufficient. UK Health Minister Steve Barclay has remained defiant to the junior doctors' request for increased pay. Barclay insists that the pay increase is sufficient and has urged the BMA to end its strikes immediately. Barclay says the pay rise of 6% announced by the government is final. This comes as Britain has been hit hard by similar such action for the past year, with NHS staff being among the main government employees calling for higher wages and better working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20 and 21. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with the industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain.
We are, as senior doctors, really concerned about the state of the NHS, and the only way we could technically make our voices heard was to strike around something that was pay and conditions. So we've had to make ourselves come to the forefront and raise our voices about the concern we have of the NHS.
The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Not only that, the unprecedented cost of living crisis in the UK has already impacted the Brits hard. Just to mention a few examples, an umbrella group has warned that London's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable as 1 in 50 Londoners are now living in temporary accommodation. The group has urged the government to help low-income families. In the case of food prices, the cost of some basic items such as cheese, butter and bread has soared to more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payment or putting food on the table. But those are just tip of the iceberg, as the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is dealing with a huge economic paralysis, from raising of interest rates to curb inflation and its subsequent impact on the UK households to a large portion of the British population being at a breaking point in dealing with their economic situation. It is not clear what lies ahead in the future for the Brits. Maybe a change in government economic policies can act as a short-term remedy to bring an end to the crisis in the UK.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
the process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. Part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy. Policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
The U.S. publication has obtained a classified document suggesting Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan from office. The document has been published by The Intercept. According to the secret cable known internally as a cipher, a meeting took place on March 7, 2022 between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. During the meeting, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Imran Khan over his neutrality over the war in Ukraine. The day before the meeting, Khan addressed a rally and responded directly to European calls that Pakistan rally behind Ukraine. During that rally, Khan said Pakistanis were not slaves to the Europeans and Americans. He said, "We are friends of Russia, and we are also friends of the U.S. We are friends of China and Europe. We are not part of any alliance." 1 month after the meeting with U.S. officials, a no-confidence vote was held in Parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The cable reveals both the carrots and the sticks that the State Department deployed in its push against Khan, U.S. officials promising warmer relations if Khan was removed. They also threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was not removed from power. The diplomatic meeting came 2 weeks after the war began between Russia and Ukraine. Before his ouster, Khan had already accused a quote foreign power of funding a conspiracy to topple his democratically elected government.
So I get this message. Donald Liu is telling the ambassador that unless Imran Khan, is removed as the prime minister in the no-confidence motion, there'll be consequences for Pakistan. It was a conspiracy. It was the army chief. It was the guy who's the prime minister right now. And the U.S. came into it as thinking as I'm someone anti-American. Some reason, if you don't agree with the U.S. foreign policy, you're turned anti-American. First, worry about your own people rather than getting involved in conflicts.
The unnamed foreign power was interpreted as a clear reference to the U.S. Following Khan's ouster from power, Pakistan plunged into a crisis. He was elected in July 2018, promising to fight corruption and to fix the economy. But those pledges went unmet, and the world's second-largest Muslim country was gripped by a financial crisis. After Khan's removal, his supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to show their support for the removed prime minister. Since his removal from power, about 200 court cases have been lodged against Khan by the military-backed government.
All my time is spent from going from one court to another courtroom. I have made, in 2 months, over 350 court appearances. And my legal team is busy fending off one case after the other. But the thing is, nothing sticks, because these are frivolous, bogus cases. And what now they are planning to do is to have military courts. And this is right now in the Supreme Court, whether the courts will allow military courts or not. And the objective of the military court is that there I certainly will be sentenced.
The former prime minister has maintained that the cases against him are politically motivated to keep him out of power. He says the country's powerful military is behind these cases. Khan has been barred from holding public office for 5 years by the country's electoral authorities. The decision was announced by the Election Commission of Pakistan days after Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption. Under Pakistani laws, a convicted person cannot run for public office for a period set out by the Election Commission of Pakistan.
The recent premature decision by the Election Commission of Pakistan is just another method for this unmandated government to try to eliminate Imran Khan from the political landscape of Pakistan. We must remember that Imran Khan was, is, and always will remain the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the largest national level party in the country. Imran Khan's case against him from a session court will be reversed.
Khan is not the first Pakistani prime minister to be convicted of alleged corruption. It is believed the political system in Pakistan is widely mired in corruption, and none of the politicians and political parties have shown any desire to fix the system. On Thursday, Pakistan's parliament was dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. But the vote could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned an economic downturn in the United States cannot be ruled out yet. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the economy is still at risk of a recession, while expressing concern over persistently high inflation in the U.S. In an interview with CBS show Face the Nation over the weekend, she said it's appropriate and normal for growth to be low. When asked about a potential recession following the June jobs report, which was the weakest since December 2020, and showed that the U.S. economy was adding fewer jobs than in previous months, Yellen said it's not completely off the table. U.S. inflation has begun to ease. It was still high after prices rose 4% year over year in May, double the U.S. Federal Reserve's 2% target, the Treasury Secretary noted. For months, the Federal Reserve has attempted to restrain inflation by hiking interest rates to their highest level in decades, slowing economic growth and prompting fears of a recession. Last month, the central bank decided not to raise interest rates further, but signaled that more rate hikes this year were possible, saying last week that a recession in 2023 is quite likely, but probably won't be deep or prolonged. According to Forbes, rising interest rates, high inflation, an inverted yield curve, and an unexpected banking crisis have all been cited as reasons that a recession could be imminent in the United States. The New York Fed recession probability indicator suggests there is a 68.2% chance of a U.S. recession sometime in the next 12 months. That's the highest reading in more than four decades. Other reliable economic indicators are flashing warning signs that the U.S. economy could soon be rolling over. The most recent core personal consumption expenditures price index data showed that this key measure of U.S. inflation was up 4.6% from a year ago. While it's down significantly from peak 2022 levels, core PCE remains well above the Fed's long-term target of 2%. That latter point is why the Fed has raised the federal funds target rate range by 5% since March 2022. But while raising rates can help lower inflation, the higher they go, the more expensive it becomes for U.S. companies to invest in innovation and growth. In addition, higher rates increase the cost of loans for regular Americans. Credit card balances, mortgage loans, and auto loans are more expensive, reducing the disposable income people have to spend, weighing on corporate earnings and stock prices. Analysts are expecting S&P 500 companies to report a 6.3% year-over-year earnings decline in the second quarter, the third consecutive quarter of negative earnings growth. The banking crisis in the U.S. has further tightened credit markets, reducing banks' willingness to lend to corporations and consumers. We'll be right back. According to Forbes, one warning sign of a U.S. recession has been flashing for investors since mid-2022. The yield on two-year U.S. Treasury notes jumped above the yields on 10-year Treasury notes, a phenomenon known as a yield curve inversion. Inverted yield curves have historically been a strong economic recession indicator. Historically, two-thirds of the time the yield curve has inverted, the U.S. economy has fallen into a recession within 18 months. The last time the yield curve inverted was in late 2019, just a few months prior to the COVID-19 recession. In early 2023, the yield curve inverted to its deepest level since 1981. CNBC also reported it has been well reported that an economic downturn could be coming to the U.S. But the question is, when might a recession happen and how bad could it be? Many Americans fear an economic downturn could be as bad as the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis, a recent nationwide survey of 2,000 adults has found. To that point, 68% are expecting a recession in the next 6 months, and 80% of those respondents expect it to be severe.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Back then, pro-Western people used to humiliate the nation, and today nation is humiliating people who are pro-Western. Today, our nation is humiliating those individuals who have such thoughts and illusions. How do they humiliate them? With these things that you have constructed and shown us here. This is humiliating people who are pro-Western. This shows the big mistake of those who wanted people to believe that the Iranian nation is incapable. For 20 years, the West has been focusing on our nuclear capabilities. Today, our nuclear facilities and progress, that is our nuclear supplies, are more than 100 times what they were 20 years ago. That is, today, we have more than 100 times the nuclear supplies that we had in 2003, which was the beginning of our nuclear challenge with the West, the continuous sanctions and the like.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who are skilled in this field and informed say this. This is the reality of our country. Of course, they did everything they could to stop this movement. They also committed crimes, assassinated people, and took these dear scientists from us by way of their atrocities. They thought that if they took Shahriari, Ali Mohammadi, and the rest from us, the work would stop. The work didn't stop. It wasn't interrupted. And thank God, it moved forward. That is, our young people and our scientists proved that this industry has been indigenized, that it belongs to the nation, and that it cannot be taken away from this nation. They now confess to this too. I would also like to say something beside the main point here. It is something beside the main point but important. You see, about 500 years have passed since the event that is known in the West as the Renaissance, the change in the path of the lives of the Westerners. During the Renaissance, the most fundamental issue that existed was the confrontation between science and religion. That is, they wanted to say that if you want to progress scientifically, you should put aside religion, spirituality, and the like. This was the most important, or one of the most important lines of the thought of the Westerners movement in the Renaissance. About 500 years have passed since that movement. Today, in the country of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is a country of spirituality and an Islamic republic, the most important scientific work is being done in competition with those who have been working in these scientific fields for so many years. Who is moving the work forward? The faithful youth, people like Fakhrizadeh and Shahriari, who were committed to praying the recommended midnight prayer, they are the ones moving the work forward. That is, science and spirituality are intertwined in this way. This is an important point that must be paid attention to.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Industrial action and strikes have been waged on a scale not seen in the United Kingdom for decades in the past year, with walkouts hitting the National Health Service, railways, airports, schools, universities, postal services, civil service, and the media industry. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. According to new analysis, nearly 4 million working days in Britain have been lost to industrial action in the past year. It finds that the strikes sparked by soaring inflation and years of stagnating pay are Britain's most intensive since the 1980s. As workers battle with the government and private employers to ease severe real-term wage cuts, the extent to which key sectors have ground to a halt, at times literally, has been further evidenced in a new report by the Resolution Foundation. Published as junior doctors continue a four-day walkout, the think tank finds that sectors including healthcare, education, postal services and railways have been responsible for 96% of all days lost to strike action since 2021. Laying bare the squeeze facing workers, the report found that real terms pay in the 3 months to May was 4.1% lower for all workers than in 2021. With that hit deepening to 9.2% for those in the public sector and to 9.8% in the healthcare and social care. Correspondingly, the report found this appears to have contributed to an increase in job vacancies, with the number of available roles in healthcare, education and public administration 33% higher in March than in December of 2019, and up 23% across the rest of the economy. The British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story. Industrial action has been waged on a scale not seen in the United Kingdom for decades in the past year, with walkouts hitting the National Health Service, railways, airports, schools, universities, postal services, civil service, and the media industry, among others. In public sector pay battles, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's insistence that granting workers' demands would further fuel inflation means his government has continued to take a tough line, despite opposition MPs warning of the strike's impact on an economy already dicing with recession. Ministers have frequently been charged with failing to properly negotiate with unions, while often bizarrely seeking to use the chaos to score political points against the Labour Party, despite Keir Starmer's visibly less than sympathetic stance on the matter. Meanwhile, the government's anti-strike legislation finally passed into law last month, despite severe defeats in the House of Lords. But although ministers have now finally agreed pay settlements with several groups, including nurses and teachers, industrial action is still being waged on several fronts, including by junior doctors and railway workers, with the latter marking the first on a national scale since the 1980s. Nai Cominetti, senior economist at the Resolution Foundation think tank, said, "The recent strikes from teachers and junior doctors reflect the fact that real-term public sector pay has fallen severely in the past few years, as well as the stress and difficult workplace conditions frequently reported by workers in these sectors." Cominetti added, "However, the inflation-driven pay squeeze should also be understood as part of a broader pattern of poor pay growth across both the public and private sectors, and falling pay satisfaction among public sector workers." Nai Cominetti added, "Going forward, the government will need to balance fiscal caution with the need to provide a level of pay for public sector workers that reflects the very real difficulties that they face in these sectors and ensure that vacancies in these sectors continue to be filled." Cominetti added, "In addition, there should also be a renewed focus on improving pay and working conditions for workers in essential sectors like social care that are largely not unionized, but which are still experiencing the effects of job stresses and pay squeezes." British newspaper The Evening Standard has also reported on the same story. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, revealed almost 4 million working days have been lost to strike action in the United Kingdom in the past 13 months. Some 3.9 million days were lost through labour disputes from June of 2022 to April of 2023. This is the highest for any period since between July of 1989 to May of 1990, when 4.8 million days were lost. December 2022 saw the most working days lost, with 829,000, the highest total for a single month since November of 2011, when the figures were at 997,000. The data comes as the National Health Service junior doctors walked out for 72 hours as part of the ongoing pursuit of improved pay and working conditions. And teachers in England announced that they would take more industrial action in the coming months. According to analysis by the Press Association news agency, disputes affecting London and North West England together accounted for nearly a third or 30% of all losses in the past 13 months. There were 576,500 days lost in London, or 16% of the total, and 526,100, or 14% of the total, lost in North West of England. South East England saw the next highest number at 466,200 days, or 13% lost, followed by Scotland, 459,500, or 12% of the total lost. Wales recorded the fewest days lost to strike action, 125,500, accounting for just 3% of the UK's total. Teachers in England, represented by the National Education Union, the NEU, are the latest union to announce that they will be walking out after striking in July in a long-running dispute over pay. Major strikes by train operators have also caused complications for the public in recent months, making life difficult in half-term and for those attending specific events such as the Eurovision Song Contest in Liverpool, the FA Cup Final in London, and the Epsom Derby, as their own long-running pay disputes rumble on. The most recent action by the RMT Union and ASLEF on 31st of May and 2nd and 3rd of June came after months of negotiations with the government failed to yield a solution and is unlikely to prove the end of the matter. Of the 3.9 million working days lost to strike action from June 2022 through to July of 2023, more than half, or 57%, or 2.1 million, were in transport, storage and communication industries, a reflection of the frequency of rail strikes, but also of recurring disputes involving Border Force staff and driving instructors. Also, according to a senior healthcare boss, junior doctor strikes have cost the National Health Service about £1 billion, as a fifth round of industrial action threatens further disruption to patient care. Julian Hartley, chief executive of NHS Providers, said hospital trusts were having to pay premium rates to consultants to cover the roles of junior doctors whilst they were on the picket lines. He said the walkouts are expected to lead to 1 million procedures and appointments being cancelled and rearranged by the time the round of action is over in 4 days' time.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum.